audiences now don't see news media the way news media think they do. I think a lot of journalists still think they're Walter Cronkite. They still think, you know, Watergate. They still think I'm a reporter. But mate, you and I both know that most journalists working in New Zealand today are going to be in PR in 3-4 years. How much do they really believe that? And it's a product. The audience knows it's a product. The media, the market knows it's a product. And people are opting out.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Chris Gilbert, a freelance journalist and correspondent from New Zealand. Chris moved to Japan in 2015 and is based in Tokyo. He has reported for Radio New Zealand, PBS, Al Jazeera, and other news outlets, while also working on his own creative projects, including Fun Radio from Japan, featuring travel stories along unbeaten paths that have a deeply personal story behind them. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I mean, I started my working career at Radio New Zealand in 2013, and I was there for a couple of years in the newsroom. And for the last 5 years, I've done a regular, like, weekly morning, like, there's a show before Morning Report called First Up. I mean, all New Zealanders will know Morning Report, but, like, the flagship radio show of New Zealand. And for the last 5 years, I've done, like, a Japan/Korea roundup for them every week. That's dropped off this year, apparently. I think they've had some funding issues. I mean, Radio New Zealand still feels like my home ground. It's very, very close to my heart and, home soil. But like I've, over the last few years, I've expanded into television. I began very much as a radio journalist. I love radio. I still love radio. Every time I go outside to do a live TV cross with my whole kit and all this crap, you know, I curse TV. I curse the microphones and the cameras and everything and the cables, and I really miss just having a Tascam and a mic and running around making things. So in the last few years, I've done TV reporting for a number of international clients through a middleman company, which kind of like would connect their, I mean, it's their clients, and they would hook me up with the broadcaster when the broadcaster needed someone in Tokyo. So like, you know, CBC in Canada, I mean, Radio New Zealand as well, SBS in Australia, Good Morning Britain, PBS sometimes, Al Jazeera sometimes, and then some less reputable ones, well, less reputable in the eyes of the Western world. Like, you know, the public broadcaster of China, CGTN's been one of my main clients, Al Arabiya, which is based in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And there's another one who I can't remember that is based in Pakistan. There's a bunch of TV clients that I have worked for.
It's interesting. I understand the comment about radio, the intimacy of it. One of the things for me about podcasts and this show always in the first year or two was audio only. Mm. And that was my sort of experience learning how to work with audio. But taking an audio first approach initially really got me comfortable with this, you know, this medium, I guess, of audio. And then bringing video into it was quite a challenge because you've got all of this gear. There's different kinds of presentation of the self. You know, you've got to put on clothes. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sweating right now. I have no idea how I look. Like,
you look great, man.
I'm not used to being on this side of the table. You know, usually I'm over there. But, you know, TV is a big jump. But how do you get on the verticals with only audio?
Yeah.
You got to get on the verticals.
Yeah.
You know, I've had bits I've made of radio and I'm like, oh man, this is such a great bite or this is such a great moment. I want to share it. There's like in a bite. And I'm like, how do I do that?
Yeah.
You know, you need the pictures.
Chris, where are you originally from?
Lower Hutt, New Zealand. Lower Hutt. And for a large part of my life, I said Wellington. You know, the big pretty city across from Lower Hutt. But I'm leaning into my Lower Hutt roots now. My suburban, you know, like the you know, I think we had two high schools that had, you know, like we're in the top five of the country for teenage pregnancy rates. You know, like it's not a very flesh part of the country. But I lean into it and I'm very proud to be from Lower Hutt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I was going to ask, what's your mountain? What's your river? It's sort of the classic pepeha kind of a thing. I mean, yeah. We're talking the Hutt River then, right?
Yeah, I mean, so when I did it as a kid, I would say like the Hutt River. I would say like, I can't remember what I said my mountain was. And I still don't really know what my mountain is. And I wouldn't know what to say today, to be honest, which is interesting because in the last 5 years, I've really found out a lot about where I come from and my whakapapa and like, you know, I'm registered with Ngāi Tahu. I know my marae is in Little River. I've been there, you know. I know a lot more about my roots in the Banks Peninsula and the South Island of New Zealand than I have in my entire life. But if you ask me now where I'm from or what my river is and everything, I wouldn't know what to say.
It's interesting. Just the other night, I met with a young guy who we just sort of connected, and he's kind of up and up on his career in advertising, and he's probably about 10 years younger than me. And we had dinner and a nice conversation in Shibuya, and he's what you would call a third culture kid. Mm. And so his father was is a Kiwi, his mother's Taiwanese, and he grew up in Japan. And so he's, you know, having this conversation with me around identity, and I'm trying to explain to him from my perspective. And interestingly, he has this kind of American international school accent. And this idea of accent is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Talking about radio, you can tell that Kiwi accent maybe from a mile away, perhaps confused with an Australian accent every now and then. But there is something about that that we kind of identify with, the sound and the words and the enunciation. And he was really sort of struggling. He was trying to explain to me, you know, I don't know, you know, what is my identity? And I said to him, man, I go through the same thing. Mm. I had a place that I was from, but I'm not there anymore.
Yeah. Where are you from? And where are you now? And where do you belong in this moment? And where are you from in this moment? And where were you from 5 years ago? And when I first moved to Japan, I've been in Japan for 10 years. And I had this moment, because New Zealand's a very small place. I mean, you're from a small place in a small place. I'm from a slightly larger place in a small place. But I came here, you moved to Tokyo and you have this like explosion. You know, you just like you've been looking at the cave wall your whole life, and you come out and you see the horizon for the first time, and you get this feeling like anything is possible. That we have the luxury of not having to be Japanese in a Japanese system, right? So for us, there's no tall poppy syndrome here, and so we can do anything we want. And so I very quickly, when I first moved here, I think moved my identity on from being a New Zealander. So, you know, and if someone asked me in those years, like, well, where are you from? I think I'd say, like, New Zealand, but I don't feel like that would be answering their question in that moment of my life, truthfully, because in that part of my life, that's not how I saw myself. I didn't see myself as a New Zealander. I mean, that's changed now. You know, I've gone through a lot more since then, but in that moment, I didn't see myself, like, if I was answering their question truthfully, that was the right answer to give them. I'm like, I'm just Chris. I'm here.
It's interesting to say that, because I think we went through a similar journey in a sense where in the first few years leaving what I refer to as those southern islands, and it's a kind of poetic language, but I think situating New Zealand as a place, the name New Zealand, it brings up these images. And the classic thing every Japanese person will say, well, isn't it beautiful and don't you have a lot of sheep? And both those things are true, but it's also a reduction of the idea of this place at the bottom of the world, these southern islands. And so my journey in the first few years here was, just like yourself, was sort of shedding that jacket. And, you know, you can sort of let yourself run free through this sort of structure of somewhere like Tokyo, this concrete and this glass and these streets, and sort of that you bounce off things. It's sort of like billiard balls will sort of bounce off everything, but you're not necessarily constrained, because it's a very permissive society in a sense as well. We've got this, you know, there are obviously rules and people are quite quick to point them out, but there is also, I guess, in an identity sense, there's a bit of a fluidity.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's quite liberating to know that you don't fit in and not have the expectations to fit in, to be so glaringly different that none of that pressure is on you. Whereas, you know, being a Pākehā, or like, you know, for like a non-New Zealand audience, being like a, you know, like a white New Zealander pretty much, in New Zealand, there's these expectations on me to be like that, to like the same things, to act the same way, to have the same values, to not, you know, like, someone said to me very recently, like, it's really hard to be a weirdo in New Zealand. And it is. you know, if there are expectations about how you should be and how you should present yourself and how you should look. And I think when I came here, I was liberated from a lot of that. I am a fairly strange person. I don't know, I don't feel like I'm a glaringly different, you know, out of step with society human. But there's just the, you know, the way you talk, the things you believe, the way you present yourself. People can kind of have a sense of expectations about you and the place you come from. And I experience it even now when I go home. I went home in January, and I think it's more stark for me now than even then. But yeah, coming here and living in such a big place and becoming anonymous is like, man, what's better than that, being anonymous, you know, in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, known by the people who care, anonymous to everybody else.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think perhaps Wellington is a really interesting site for this kind of conversation, because that's kind of maybe arguably where the weirdos of New Zealand congeal, perhaps.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we both found ourselves there.
I think Wellington is where all like the self-proclaimed weirdos are. You know, I mean, I was at university in the late noughties, so at Vic, and, you know, and that was the era of, like, you know, when we all dressed like Pete Doherty, or, like, you know, what's the guy from The Vales, like Andrew Finn, is that his name? Anyway, something Finn Andrews, you know, I mean, anyway. But, like, we all had, like, these brimmed hats and, like, skinny jeans and, like, pointy leather boots, and we hung out, like, at Mighty Mighty, or, like, I don't know, it's going to mean nothing to anyone that's not from Wellington, but, like, you know, and we would just like smoke clove cigarettes or whatever cigarettes we could afford. And we were just like incredibly pretentious hipsters, you know, and then but there's an element of elitism that comes with that. And it was kind of a reality check, because when I graduated from Vic very slowly, eventually, because I was spending so much time having fun, I ended up going to New Zealand Broadcasting School to study broadcasting. And I was kind of expecting people like me, you know, like intelligentsia, like tertiary educated, like liberal, like, you know, like very leftist thinking, like arts background kind of thing. And no, it was like a whole bunch of kids straight out of high school from different parts of the country that my elitist brain at that time considered to be, you know, like, well, you know, normal humans that aren't like us cool, intelligent hipsters or whatever. And it was a great experience for me, because I learned everyone's weird. The most normal people in the world are weird. You know, everyone has things that'll catch you off guard and make you laugh and surprise you. And I think I've had a few experiences like that in my life where I've left my ivory tower, including when I left Radio New Zealand and came here, including when I left here and moved to Vancouver for a year, just before the pandemic started. And I ended up just on a working in a Vietnamese restaurant and waxing snowboards on some ski shack north of Vancouver. I've had a few experiences in my career which have taught me over and over again to not do, I mean, my experience, journalism and tall buildings, and to always approach people with an open mind and with empathy. So I'm very thankful that I was an elitist hipster in my youth, because it taught me, it kind of taught me not to be.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
The side of journalism, I think back, you know, what got me into doing this? And we'll get into this in a moment, but the turning point for me was the COVID protests in Wellington in 2022, and seeing the literal ivory tower of the mainstream media, you could call it the New Zealand media establishment, on the balcony of Parliament, looking down at this protest, and then myself, you know, mingling amongst the people and trying to get a feel for what was actually going on. And for me, those in the high tower were reporting on the situation, whereas I was doing journalism amongst the people and trying to feel out the situation. And that was the beginning for me, that there was kind of maybe a sense of perspective difference between those two.
I feel like there's no end to journalism. I feel like reporting is a product. Journalism is a pursuit. That's what I feel like, is that you can work as a reporter making reports. You're not necessarily a journalist. And I'm very suspicious of anyone that does call themselves, walk around calling themselves a journalist. And I'm not suspicious, like I've got a checklist of things that they, you know, they have to, you know, like I'm the journalist police or something. It's not like that. But I feel like the term is used very liberally and very loosely. And sometimes in some applications more correctly than it used to be. But for example, I mean, maybe this is cliche now, but I feel like Anthony Bourdain unintentionally became an amazing journalist. Because Anthony Bourdain, until he did stop, never stopped. You know, he kept an open mind everywhere he went. He spoke to people. He listened to people. He walked in to most situations with his own personal beliefs. He owned his own personal prejudices and beliefs, and he listened. He agreed or disagreed. But ultimately, he never went into any position as a master. And I feel like there's a lot of pressure on the quote-unquote fourth estate to always be voices of authority, you know, that we are the defenders of democracy, you know, and we are, you know, we are endeavoring to hold power to account. And I think when you're reporting, most of the time, you don't have the time to do that. You don't have the resources, and you don't have the mental bandwidth. Especially now. I mean, I could go on about this for a while.
Well, but yeah. I just wonder, this, you were just telling me earlier how you were doing, I believe you call it a piece to camera. A PTC, which PTC. Is the reporter, you know, on a TV clip, you know, on the ground in Tokyo, on the ground in Lebanon, on the ground in London, whatever, talking to the camera to, I think, contextualize it, right? To give it a sense of authority that we have someone there.
It's to show that the person's there. Yeah.
Even if the rest of the article or the reporting is done somewhere else, it's sort of, it's almost like a, I don't want to say pretending, but it's like
you can say pretending.
Legitimizing it by having the dude in front of the camera there, and this kind of production cycle of getting those clips and that, which seems to be quite important to a lot of media institutions. But is it really the story, you know, or is it just the piece to camera?
The piece to camera is one element of a story, right? And so you can have multiple elements to make a TV story or a radio story. And having the reporter live with it, I mean, originally the purpose of it is meant to be like, I mean, is to be like, yes, there is a person here with the demolished building behind them after the earthquake. I mean, that is the best stuff, right? But usually when there's breaking news like that, you want a live cross to give live updates, right? But it is an element that's part of a story, but you know, it is a little bit trite sometimes in control. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. Like this morning I did mine like a meter from my apartment because I know that there's an element that I have to put in a story. It was a story that I was making, which didn't really have a place that anchored it to any particular place. It was about a concept or a broader topic that was going on. And it's like, cool, I have to do this thing. I did this thing, I put it in the story. But I think you're kind of picking away at the right line of questioning, which is like, well, how much legitimacy is there really to these products? Because they are products. And how much do they reflect journalism? And how much do they reflect truth? And what is the value of them? I mean, my opinion's not very popular, but I feel like reporters and journalists or whatever, people in the media sphere, are desperately hanging on to these old myths. These old stories we tell ourselves about who we are and what we're doing. I feel like I will just say, I've been doing this for 13, 14 years. We're making a product. We're making a media product. And it's really honestly time that we start saying that we're not Walter Cronkite. I mean, it's not romantic. It's not great. It's not fantastic. We're not heroes. That we have to really start pulling that down. Like, you know, like if you pull back the curtain of this to reveal Oz, it's just me doing the same thing over and over again in front of Premiere Pro. It's like, honestly, like I think I mentioned to you the other, before, like last time I met with you, Cody, like about, you know, the very tragic mosque shootings in New Zealand, like one of the absolute darkest, most horrific days in New Zealand history, which really, I think, uncovered a real truth that's in the underbelly of New Zealand, you know, that could have been exposed. And I saw reporters being like, talking about their colleagues in New Zealand. I was here, but talking about the colleagues being like, oh, I'm so proud of my colleagues and all the reporting they did today. And I was like, you stood outside with a microphone. and talked. Like, that's what we're doing. I mean, I feel like I have some authority to say that because I have stood on the curb all night doing 13, 14 live hits back to back to back to back to back to back after like huge disasters here. You know, I've got the hours under my belt live on TV to know what this is. And I don't really have the patience or the time for people to pretend like it's this grand, you know, like it's this noble pursuit that we're doing to stand on the street talking. That's what we're doing. And I can guarantee you that if you're standing on the street talking all night doing live crosses, as the sun moves around the world and breakfast shows wake up for different clients and they all want to know the same two questions, what's the latest and what does it mean? What are people saying? It's the same questions over and over again. It's the same answers over and over again all around the world. And you don't have the time to be a journalist looking at your phone. I barely have the time to look at updates, you know? Reporting is a product and I really feel like the audiences, the new audiences, skipping past, you know, like newspapers losing the classifieds, following, you know, media to vertical scrolling, skipping past that. We know that story. We know that has affected the media industry. We know about paywalls and blah, 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 blah. But I feel like what's not being discussed is audiences now don't see news media the way news media think they do. I think a lot of journalists still think they're Walter Cronkite. They still think, you know, Watergate. They still think I'm a reporter. But mate, you and I both know that most journalists working in New Zealand today are going to be in PR in 3-4 years. How much do they really believe that? And it's a product. The audience knows it's a product. The media, the market knows it's a product. And people are opting out.
Well, it's interesting, the idea of maybe our childhood growing up, that there was this sort of golden age, and that's perhaps up for debate. There's a myth-making there. But at least, you know, the 6 o'clock news, you know, TV1, this was, you know, part of our daily cycle. That has certainly changed. That's not coming back. But I guess what I find quite seducing about it is there is a kind of, you know, there's the production, there's a sense of something happening there. You know, it's not citizen journalism. It's not just people tweeting about something. You know, there are production values. You know, people make sure that the audio and the lighting and everything's working well. Yeah. But then can you combine that with a sense of penetration into reality, which is, I think, what we're doing as independents, which is, you know, some of my experiences where, you know, one day I'm meeting a former governor of the Bank of Japan, or I'm talking to a minister, or I'm talking to some, you know, controversial figure about something, and the next day I'm on the street and I'm talking to someone else, and it's sort of kind of my, yeah, and this is like Anthony Bourdain. I mean, it's absolutely subjective. You know, I'm not trying to purport to find truth. I'm trying to find out something from my perspective.
I mean, can you connect it to something real? Yeah. Can you anchor it and ground it rather than just talking about these things that we talk about, like strained tensions, these things that mean nothing?
Well, you know? I'll give you an example. So there's this whole thing happening with Iran and Israel and in the US. In this studio just the other week, I had a guy, former Iranian diplomat, telling me about 1979. And one of my things has always been time slip. Like, I don't, even though it's relevant to our life right now, having having this you know, oil shock and these prices going up and stuff, I'm actually much more interested, okay, where did this come from? And what was his personal story living through that period, 1979? And, you know, maybe we'll touch on what happened today, but that's like someone telling me their story. And that is worth so much more than some analyst who's monitoring the situation saying, well, this is maybe what Iran's going to do. It's like, well, no, I'm going to find out from a guy, and it's clearly his perspective, but it's like, it's a very human approach. And that's, I mean, that's storytelling in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things there. I mean, the first thing is resources. If you want to do that, you need resources, and you need to equip newsrooms and journalists and reporters and editors and chief reporters with resources, not just things, but time. And it's hard to get real voices into stories when you have to make, you know, when I was at Radio New Zealand, making a radio package every day, which is like a 5 minute story, for 3 to 5 minutes. I do three interviews, and I write it, I edit it, I deliver it to my show when I go home. And I mean, it's the same thing for TV, but it's, you know, because of the reality that newsrooms now are so underfunded to do the kind of reporting that you're talking about and the kind of reporting that I believed in when I became a reporter, when I pursued journalism, I obviously don't really believe in this particular sphere anymore, but I very much believe that it's still doable and can be profitable. But, you know, you really need to equip people with time, and it's just, you know, the only way that I can really be viable in Japan is I'm a one-stop shop. I can do everything. I don't need a producer, you know, I don't need a lighting person. I don't need a videographer. I do it all myself. So I'm more affordable.
Well, you know, it's interesting. And again, I think we are developing something here, because coming back to that imminence and that reality check, I just want to read you something from my diary notes from 2022. So we had, I went out to the big protest on 8th February at Parliament. It was quite awe-inspiring to see the trucks and camper vans roll in and block Molesworth Street and take over the grounds. Generally, it was family-friendly, whānau, a hippie kind of vibe with a pinch of Christian. I manned the roadblock and took some photos. It was all pretty ragtag and chaotic. A bus backed into someone's car. The people had no intention of leaving, though, and some people camped on. Apparently today, though, it was a different story. The police came in, trespassed some people, and it all started heating up. This is no longer able to be swept under the rug, and of course, media and police are provoking people. The government has unanimously turned a blind eye and ignored what is literally going on their doorstep. What is next? I'm still not holding out hope. It could be like Hong Kong, where it just fades away and we never get our rights back. We are bracing for endemic vaccine passports, lockdowns, and perpetual bullshit. Honestly, though, the people get caught up as ideologues on both sides, and I could feel that. Humans are susceptible to this kind of stuff. I went and took photos and exercised my democratic rights to free assembly, but I did not get caught up in the Kool-Aid on either side. I'm not sure if that is a minority or actually the majority. And that was from my diary. And as I said, my realization that maybe I have some skills with storytelling, maybe I have some observations, and importantly, I don't mind getting amongst it. And when I saw the media up on that pulpit looking down at these people and claiming things about them that they hadn't actually verified for themselves, or even if they came in and tried to do an interview, they were painting it with a certain lens. For me, that was the awakening. And I don't know if that was naivete or...
I mean, I've had them too, those kinds of things. I mean, I'm interested in your idea of a certain lens, like what you think. Because you're talking about like the way that the mainstream media, let's say the lamestream media, right? The way that they portray this. That's what you're talking about, right? So what do you think that certain lens?
On their side?
Yeah.
I think they were painting it as a fringe, unreasonable, perhaps a bit violent, irrational movement in the face of overwhelming fact and compelling circumstances, and that these people were just out of line and almost beyond, beneath them.
But in service of who? That's the thing. In service of who? Because that is, I mean, it's Benedict Anderson's Imagine Community. That is not the news media necessarily. I mean, people get so angry at journalists and reporters as if journalists and reporters have a vendetta against going around trying to be assholes. You know, it's like, oh, I hate bloody blah, blah, blah on TV and Z. It's like, why? It's just a person doing a job.
Creating products.
It's like getting angry at someone at checkout. It's like they have a contract. They're on a shift. And it's like, oh, these reporters. And it's like, why are you getting angry at the nice person that works at Bunnings? There's no point. You know, it's like you go to Bunnings, you buy something, it doesn't work properly, and you get angry at the person that sold it to you. And it's like, no, they're just working a shift, man.
I used to work retail. I know exactly what it's like.
Yeah, of course. They come after you. Anyone who has worked retail or service knows, like, you can tell because they are so nice to people who work in retail and service, you know.
I can't imagine being rude to a staff member.
No way.
Can you, like,
No way.
Maybe that's a Kiwi thing, maybe? I don't know.
No, because Kiwis are rude to staff members. Australasia is the home of sending things back.
Yeah.
You know, I was back at home, someone like thought their like food was too lukewarm or something and sent it back. And I was like, oh my God. But I mean, going back to the conversation though, it's like they're making a product on behalf of a community. And the community is, in New Zealand case, Kiwi, right? If it's the 6 o'clock news. But you could look at it a different way, which is that they're making a product on behalf of a market. And a certain market is going to go to The Guardian. The certain market is going to go to New York Times, Fox News, Breitbart. I mean, I was talking to some New Zealand academics just a couple of days ago who are here in Tokyo, and they were talking to me about my work, and I taught them about how I was doing some work. Well, one of my main clients has been the English language national broadcaster in China. And they asked me, well, what kind of stories do you do for them? And I said, well, quite honestly, the main stories that they like is anything that makes Japan look bad. And they were like shocked. I'm like, why are you so shocked? It's a product for a market. It's if you do a story for the Chinese broadcaster about anything to do with like border issues in that part of the country, you have to be very sensitive about that too. And on the continent, it's the same for CNN. If I do a story about, you know, like China or Japan China tensions for an American market, they're going to have certain expectations about what you say and what you don't say. And that is really why I think people, they see through this now. They know it's never been more clear because people are getting all kinds of truths on their phone, and they see that the old legacy media institutions are telling them the same version of the truth over and over and over again. And that's on behalf of maybe, I guess you could say, a market, a community, an audience, maybe even an electorate that doesn't exist anymore. Or is being dismantled because, and I'm interested in the pining for prestige or for authority, because to me, I mean, I feel the same thing. And to me, it is potentially a mourning as we realize that the institutions that, I mean, especially for our generation, for millennials, the institutions that we were told to believe in growing up, we now realize we can't really believe in these myths and fables. They're not really serving the functions that they were meant to serve. The yellow brick road doesn't really lead to owning a home necessarily. You know what I mean? And for younger people today, they've been born into this world.
Have you ever had the experience, you're doing these back-to-back live crosses and you're saying, it may be the same thing or maybe something else, but it's like two different sides of the media. So I don't know, maybe you got like Fox News followed by CNN type situations. Has that happened to you before? We almost like putting on a different hat.
It's a good question. I'm trying to think of what the wildest extreme would be. I think, you know, like water against stone, it all rounds out for me. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's all just the news, baby. I think for me, like personally, I will report what I report based on the facts that I gather, based on the interviews that I do, and that's kind of where it is for me. I will know that if I have a particular client that doesn't like any references to, I don't know, like shrines or temples in Japan, you know, in terms of my visuals that I might gather, I'll make sure I keep those out. And it's the same for editorial things that you're saying, you know, editorial decisions. I'll know, for example, that if there is like a literal territorial dispute going on between China and Japan, that is something that I personally would rather avoid because I know that my client is not going to like that. And, you know, there might be reporters and journalists out there that say that it's not brave or say that I'm backing down or whatever, but I'd say you do the same thing. We all do the same thing.
Well, it's interesting because, again, I think this is where I come back to my own agency, in a sense, where, you know, what is it that I'm doing?
Yeah,
I'm trying to find out for myself. And this leads to a sense of, you know, for people who listen to my show, I think they're on a bit of a journey together where one week I'm talking to this person, one week I'm talking to that person. And it's I mean, it's a little bit chaotic. It's not necessarily going to be the same kind of topic, even though initially I was covering the same kind of thing. You know, I've gone down basically what am I interested in. Last week it was neoliberalism. This week it's talking about New Zealand media. Next week, what's it going to be? And for me, that's as authentic to myself as I can be, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe part of the difference here, that you're working, you've got a little bit more, I guess, skin in the game with, you know, your work and getting these jobs. I'm not necessarily expecting to monetize, and I hate that word, but, you know, this show, it is what it is. It's my own personal discovery. If I wasn't recording it, I would still be reading about the stuff that I'm interviewing people about.
Yeah, and talking to people about it. I mean that's part of it, you know. Like I worked with a producer once here in Tokyo who insisted on working from the Foreign Correspondents Club as his base. And I mean, that's fine. Everyone needs a place to work. But it got to the point where I had to have a chat with them and be like, hey, like, we don't do journalism up tall buildings. You know, like, we do it talking to people down here, on the street. And that's really where the magic happens.
You know? And I think that... that sense, and perhaps this loops back, you know, I mean, again, the word Kiwi is one of those funny words, but I do think there is something about the New Zealand, the imagined idea of New Zealand, at least, which is, we are these Southern Islands, no one even knows where it is, really. Yeah. Everyone thinks we're from Australia. People have asked me, are you from England? Maybe I am, but the idea that New Zealand is nowhere, and from nowhere, that's a very interesting position to negotiate conversations, and so... And I hate to say it, but, you know, a lot of my American friends, you know, there is baggage with being American.
Of course.
And maybe our baggage is more like carry-on baggage as Kiwis, but I feel that that position means I can go and talk to this person, I can go and talk to that person, and I'm just sort of trying to feel out, well, what are they about? What is their whole thing? What's their shtick? And I think that's an interesting place to be. It's sort of a third place.
Well, I think going back to where are you from, and when we were talking about that right at the start, I mean, one question that came into my mind, what are people really asking? Is they're asking, who are you? I mean, people don't care, like, necessarily where you're geographically from. They care about everything that goes along with that. You know, I mean, how many times has everyone been in a situation where you meet someone at a bar or a cafe or at a party or at a wedding and you ask them the icebreaker questions, where are you from? And they say something and your brain goes, oh, God, I've got nothing. You know, it's like, you know, Poland. What do I know? Nothing. You know, we're trying to connect with people and we're trying to find mutual ground and we're trying to figure out who you are. But, you know, there are boxes that come along with that, you know, and especially if you know a bit about where people are from. I think one difference between New Zealand and America in particular is that I feel like the countries that are a bit noisier, and maybe, I mean, America's not that old. Maybe Japan is actually a better example. But I feel like there are countries in the world that New Zealand could learn from that are not afraid to talk about their ghosts and not afraid to talk about their baggage. I feel like New Zealand, and this is a conversation that's happening a lot now. I think you had a very similar conversation with Mike Grimshaw from University of Canterbury, right? Mm. And there are some other books that I've been reading. One of them is The Unsettled. I think it was Professor Shaw from Massey. But there's a conversation going on in Aotearoa at the moment, which is very much about, well, do we lean so hard into this imagined identity for ourselves to avoid a conversation, to avoid asking questions about who we are and where we're from, to avoid uncomfortable truths? And, you know, I've talked a lot about the 24-hour media cycle, but, you know, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that that's not where my heart is and where my passion is. I think we're very similar in what we care about. And what I care about is looking for stories that I see as a blind spot in a discourse and a narrative. And I'm working on one right now, a documentary right now for a New Zealand audience. And I think that's what I care about. And I feel like even though the 24-hour news cycle, like, I feel like that the model of that product is becoming somewhat redundant. I I have a very firm belief in an internal truth, which is that there will always be a need, no matter the technology, there will always be a need for human-to-human communication and human-to-human storytelling. So the product that I make, whether it's a 24-hour news story or a documentary, is never going to go out of style. You know, it's just redirecting our efforts towards something that I think is more important.
Storytelling.
Yeah.
This is interesting. I think, again, I might have alluded to it, but and the language is tough. We talk about prestige, but I think what I'm really sort of getting at is trying to connect the past back into the present. And sort of in that 24-hour news cycle, there's no room to take a breath.
Yeah.
There's no room to take a step back. And as I said, when the world is talking about Iran 2026, I'm talking about Iran 1979.
Yeah.
When the world's talking about Trump or the latest tariffs, I'm going back to Bretton Woods or the gold standard or the New Deal in the United States. You know, I'm always trying to go, I'm sort of out of step. And this is maybe my interest in history coming through, but I really do feel that we can learn a lot from going back to those moments. And with this kind of vast distance of history, look at those, and then those can sort of fold back into what's happening today, because we are standing upon, I guess, the project of humanity. The civilization is this ongoing thing, right?
Yeah.
And in the sort of reporting, there's no time to talk about that shit.
I mean, we'll try to make anyone care. That's the thing. I mean, you're talking about art. I mean, Bjork said that art is taking our old myths and our old legends and applying them to the future. You know, it's crystal ball gazing using past lessons through a medium which in the now doesn't actually exist. We have to create it. Reporting is all about saying what is going on around us, and it's got the curse of objectivity, because it's like, oh, I'm not part of this. Oh, this has got nothing to do with me. Oh, I'm just here as a spectator. And it's like, well, what's your value then? Go home. I'll do that. You know, objectivity is an absolute curse, because to do what you're talking about, you have to be subjective. And as resources dry up in the media world, we have leaned so hard into being objective to maintain our mana or our status or our authority. We are the fourth estate, a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. We're the fact checkers. No one cares about facts anymore. We're in the second Trump term. What do facts matter? Storytelling. And it affects. The facts have only led downstream towards power for decades now. And if you are objective, here's a real story I did at Radio New Zealand, right? Real story I did at Radio New Zealand. Love Radio New Zealand. No shade on them. This is just the product. This is the news media, right? But a real story I did was there was a highway being built to replace Centennial Highway between Wellington and the Kapiti Coast. It's called Transmission Gully. It was going through, I think it was through Pika Pika, a place near the coast. And the story is a protest against it. Now, who do you think the audience is on the side of? The three guys or families or whatever, they're like, don't demolish our homes. We don't want to. We don't want this. Or the NZTA being like, we're going to cut, you know, your travel time to work by 40 minutes. New road. Taxpayer dollars in action. Beautiful. Love it. Oh, it's a dream. Wanted this my whole life. Finally happening. Thank you, government. You report a little bit from column A and a little bit of column B from that story and tell me it's journalism. I'm serious. It needs to be subjective. You have to lend some weight. You have to support the underdog. Otherwise, you want true objectivity. You need to pursue equity, not equality. You know, you have to be like, okay, but you really need to lift up the voice of those people who don't have any power. And I think in my career, I've decided that my pursuit, whether, and this is like a random compass, which is leading me all through everywhere in the media world, but my pursuit is to point my microphone, since I have the privilege of it, in directions that need voices that need amplifying.
You alluded to a documentary project.
Yes.
Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm making a documentary at the moment called Borderless. And condensing this down, because I mean, this is going to be a little bit like surgery, walking in on surgery halfway through, right?
Yeah.
I'm still figuring this out for myself. You know, I think another thing that creators in general and storytellers will know is that talking about a thing that's currently in process is very dangerous. It could all fall apart. But my documentary, the one that I'm making at the moment, is about the identity of New Zealanders who are the children of immigrants. And they're not necessarily children, they could be our age. And what it means to be a third culture kid, but not necessarily that, but what it means to be put in a box by a society that you don't fit into, whether that's from X country Asian, or whether you pass because you don't look like Pakeha expect you to look as someone that is half Cantonese or half Chinese or whatever, or if you have an attachment to your language or you don't have an attachment to your language, and you know, whether you have completed and are at one with your identity, or if you are somewhat, you have holes and things are missing and you're divorced, and you know, because the immigrants to New Zealand, particularly from Asia, you know, they had to go through assimilation. You have to keep your head down, don't stand out, don't cause trouble, don't bring your loud minority cultures with the way the food smells and, you know, what's in the school lunches and all. Don't bring that here. You've got to kind of be quiet. How are New Zealanders today who went through that experience, you know, as kids, how are they reconciling their identity? And the point is that societies, and this goes back to your, like, the audience of the lens of the media world, what the lens that the mainstream media, who is in service of, is the same community. You know, the story of New Zealand doesn't have room at the moment for these voices. And I know that because they told me. And that's what I mean by amplification. This story is happening because these people, you know, these participants have been telling me there's no representation of our experience of being a New Zealander at all. You know, like, I'm here, I have one passport, and I am this, and I'm this, and I'm this, I'm all of these things, and none of that is really truly represented here because New Zealanders have an idea or a place that they put Asian people in New Zealand, or whether they think you are or not. You know, as one person said, my name is three syllables, get it right. You know, and some of them might have gone through microaggressions, some might not have gone through microaggressions, some might have been bullied, some might not have been bullied, some might live in Tokyo now. The point is that it is a diverse spectrum of experiences and identity. And the conclusion is, don't assume, don't judge. And I think that's very important for a New Zealand audience. Yeah.
That's exciting, man.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You talk about New Zealand. Here we are in Japan, and I reflect on the same thing, but from the other side, which is that I was just walking to the train station today, and there was like some political figures handing out brochures, I guess, the way they do canvassing here for elections and things. And they sort of motioned to give me their flyer, and I just sort of kept walking because it's like, well, obviously I don't have voting rights in this country.
Yeah.
Only citizens do. And so, obviously, I'm not franchised, even though I pay taxes here and I live here. And that conversation of, okay, well, what does a more diverse Japan mean, where there's 4 million, you know, at least on paper, 4 million foreign residents and many more who have naturalized. But there's this kind of idea that of a monoculture, more specifically here, I would say even more than New Zealand, that when you're not part of the monoculture, You, and obviously we stand out here. This was one of the things we first came here. We're not part of the system here.
Thank God.
And what does that mean in terms of, okay, what are the stories to be told here, which are very conveniently ignored, you know, in the Japanese media?
It's startling to me, like, how similar New Zealand and Japan are in some ways. You know, and the assumptions that they make about people, like, New Zealand would never want to think of itself as not necessarily a monoculture, but, you know, definitely a narrow one. There's definitely a lane of acceptability about how to be a New Zealander or how not to be a New Zealander. And I think
Japan too.
Yeah. And New Zealand and Japan and New Zealand aren't and equally are not very tolerant of anything that's outside those lands, and they try and qualify them. And this is what the story is really, the story I'm making is really about, is people who are tired of having to explain and qualify their existence, that they should just be. You know, so to use the story you just told of someone handing you, you know, a political flyer. I mean, people do it to me too, and I'm like, I can't vote, you know, but they don't know that. They don't know that I'm not Japanese, because that there are white Japanese people. You know, like my daughter, you know, she's 1/8 Japanese, right? Her grandmother is half, right? But if we're here for another 20, 30 years, what's she? You know, I mean, it's the third culture kid thing again. She defines that for herself, not other people. And the point is that, you know, we need to, no one needs to do anything. But like my desire is for less judgment and less assumption and less like, oh, you must be this. You know, you don't know anything about, I mean, the world is becoming more complicated. And another thing that one of the people in my documentary said, because I'm case studying like 6 to 8 people, is we're all mixed. All of us are mixed.
It's interesting, this on the 14th floor of this big building in Shibuya, where I was having dinner with this young creative the other day. He explained it to me that he has a binder of identities, and this is a metaphor, but he's able to sort of open up this thing that's like a binder and pull the one out that's most relevant. And
like, so like a Rolodex.
A Rolodex, yeah, you know, you can sort of choose the one that's most appropriate. And he, you know, if he's in Japan, he speaks Japanese fluently. He speaks Chinese fluently. He speaks English. But he's kind of, assessing a situation and choosing, okay, I'm going to go for this one. And not, it's too much friction to kind of negotiate anything else. It's like, all right, this is my shot.
Yeah.
And I find that a very interesting way of thinking about it, because, you know, maybe most people are on just a single page, right? Yeah. But what happens, especially once you start traveling, or once you have that experience of being a third culture child, you have these sort of identities that you can pull out from the folder.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah. And as someone who is collecting these stories, I don't feel like it's anyone's job to educate other people and to have an expectation of the audience they have to do homework and learn. You know, some people might benefit, some people might not. But the point is the amplification of the voices. The point is that there are people who and this is when you know you've kind of struck gold a little bit when you're in this work, is when they say to you, when the people who are in the story that you're case studying say to you, oh, thank God someone's talking about this. And if that happens 2 or 3 times, you're like, all right, keep going, keep pulling. I don't necessarily know where this is going to lead yet. As I said, halfway through, you know, surgery halfway through. I don't know where this documentary is going to lead to, or what conclusion it's going to lead to, or if there even will be a conclusion. But the thing is that those people, the participants in my documentary, they really have something to say. And if they have something to say, then who am I to be like, sorry, it's, you know, got to do geopolitics, it's not important. You know, because the thing is that to get funding for these stories, we have to justify it. We have to say, why now? We have to fit it into this old model, you know, and sell it and everything. And but I feel like it's such an important, especially in the modern climate, that the current climate, where there is so much prejudice and discrimination and xenophobia, and cheap, quick answers to big problems being supplied by false leaders. You know what I mean? And it's like people in the world like just have legitimate angers, very legitimate angers about how things are in their lives, you know, like in terms of a lack of political agency, you know, in terms of how things are economically, you know. And these leaders have come along in lieu of anyone saying what the real answers are, who are pointing to groups of people and saying it's their fault, it's their problem to get elected, pointing people in all the wrong directions. And I really think that the more that we amplify voices that aren't being heard, and not just on our side of the battle, not just in what like we believe, but also going to people who we don't necessarily agree with or people that we might find repulsive even, and trying to understand where they're coming from. You know, I don't know. I feel like I'm getting all hippy dippy, you know, like it's just love. Let's just love each other, you know.
I was going to say that we've maybe painted a picture of the negative, the wrong direction.
Yeah.
The pathway forward then is this word love. I mean, what does that mean? What does it mean to follow that
love,
that path?
I mean, there's very little time in my, apart from my friends and family, I don't really, love doesn't come into the pitches that I send out. You know, I think like love and art are completely taboo in this world that I operate in, especially art. You can't be arty and a journalist at the same time. We are very serious people. It's another thing is journalists take themselves so seriously. It's just a job, you know. Mm. But I mean, what's the way forward? I mean, I'm figuring that out for myself at the moment. I have a belief, and I think it's the right one, that, as I said earlier, there will always be a need for human storytelling. And I think with that comes humanity, and I think with that comes empathy, and I think with that comes love. We're all just getting along doing our thing, you know. Like it is, I love comes into journalism the moment that we stop thinking that we anything about the story that we're covering. Chris, and we let people tell us.
Chris Gilbert, thank you.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.